Park Place, Monday morning, 13th May 1974. If we study one of the great discourses of the Buddha very carefully, in which he expounds the Four Noble Truths, we will find that with regard to the Second Noble Truth, which deals with the cause of dukkha, of suffering, of ill, he mentions preoccupations of the mind. Now we all know, if we are the least bit mindful in the course of the day, how our attention is captured by some sort of thought, or maybe a tune, or whatever it may be, a mood, and so forth. The mind, in fact, is obsessed. Even when we are in what we might consider a calm and a balanced state, the mind is constantly preoccupied, obsessed with something or other. Where do these obsessions originate? They originate in our life experience from the time we are born onwards, experiences which are associated with pleasure, with fear, anxiety, aversion, and so on. And because these inevitably are not worked out fully whilst we are going through the experience, after all, no child can possibly do it, and even grown-ups do not do it and cannot do it, because they are not fully worked out, they remain in the mind as the mental impressions, the vasanas, and they come up into consciousness. They obsess the mind. They all belong to the past. And occasionally they are associated with our own wishful, desirous anticipation of the future, our fantasies about what we are going to do or be, our fantasies of success and happiness in the days to come. What is the consequence of this obsession? We are unable to be fully attentive to the immediate moment. We think we are concentrating our attention upon it, but we are not really. In modern times, you know how thousands of people, millions in fact, have a perpetual radio in the background. They say it helps them. Some say at least it helps them. But this perpetual sound, this distraction in the background means that full attention cannot be given to the here now. Whether it's a radio or whether it's our own thoughts associated, as I've just said, with our pleasure, fear, anxiety, violence, hatred, upset, whatever it may be. It prevents us from being truly mindful of the here now. One might ask, what is the cure for this? It causes a distraction of the mind. Observe the distraction. Don't try to put it aside. Since I am fond of music, often tunes will just run through my mind obsessively. Can't get rid of them. They keep on repeating themselves. All of us, sometime or other, have some sort of anxiety, some sort of fear. And it keeps on repeating itself. And it gives rise to fantasies of all sorts. What I should do and what could be done, and they're all fantasies, really. Because the actual situation, the actual circumstance here now is different from what is coming up into consciousness through memory. This is an extremely difficult problem to deal with. Very difficult indeed. And we must not fight against that which is obsessing the mind. Look at it. But look at it without indulging it if it is pleasant. Look at it without resisting it if it is unpleasant. Just look at it. And see it impersonally. This is the first big step, and perhaps the most important step. Every such obsession of the mind is related to the self-center. I. Try and abstract to free the mind from the intrusion of the I, the relationship to oneself. See the thing as it is. This is fear. This is indulgence in pleasure, or whatever it may be. See it as such, and keep looking at it so completely that your power of attention grows and grows. Without indulging, without resisting. Then you will find that gradually these unworked out impressions in the mind, or the stimuli brought up by the immediate circumstance or problem at hand, will cease in course of time to topple you over. You will not lose your inner equanimity. Inwardly you'll be stable. You will know for a certainty in its real depth and fullness, the meaning of that great statement of the Buddha, whatsoever hath a beginning hath an ending. In the first instance, that applies to the Dhamma, That's the Pali word used, the Dhamma, which of course has so many translations. But use it primarily in the sense in which it applies to the thought process, to the mind process. The state of mind, the Dhamma, that's the plural, are the states of mind in which we are. A state of mind arises, and by patient and persevering attentiveness, you will get that poise which will enable you to be well aware that this state of the mind which has arisen will pass away. Now do not think of it in terms of, oh, this is a frightful storm come down, we'll just put up our umbrella or raincoats and we'll wait till the storm is over. No, observe the storm, experience the storm. Absorb the fullness of the storm in your own psyche, otherwise it's useless. Don't repeat the formula, because then it will just become a dead thing and ineffective. It will not be a healing medicine. Don't repeat the formula. Ah, this has arisen, it'll pass away. It's 5 o'clock now, 5:30, 6. It ought to be passing away by 6:15. No, that's absolutely inefficient. It doesn't work. Look at the thing as it is. It happens to be a distraction at the moment, taking you away from what you have to pay attention to. The thing of the immediate circumstance. But nevertheless, pay attention to that distraction. Pay full attention to it as much as possible. Absorb it, understand it, and know within that, yes, this will undergo its transformation, its change, and it will end. But see to it that the ending is a true ending. Which means that by your attentiveness, by absorbing it sensitively in your own psyche, realizing that it is relative, impermanent, not ultimate truth or reality, that it is a source of ill in itself, realizing all that, the distraction is transformed. Whether the distraction is due to pleasure, pain, anxiety, confidence, hilarity, whatever it may be. Now you see, this is one of the very difficult aspects of mindfulness. Very difficult indeed. Our natural tendency is to think of it all the time in terms of myself. Why has this happened to me? What am I to do about it? Try and let that self-center dissolve away. This is what has come up. What is its meaning, its significance? What is its origin? Is it greed? Is it hate? Is it delusion? Is it fear? Is it stupidity? Is it ambition? Is it envy? Is it jealousy? Is it the passion to rush about doing good? Making the best of the opportunity in the opportunist sense. We are all like that. Because although all of us may be a little bit holy, we are not quite there yet. So be very careful and watchful. If you are really careful, watchful, and divest yourself of this I center, then you will really learn. You will learn the nature of the psyche and its functioning. You will grow in true self-knowledge, that is to say, knowledge of the ways of your own mind and heart. It is that self-knowledge which is needed, not the academic self-knowledge which, for example, in conventional psychological practice we have. This is due to such and such a complex or such and such a thing. That's all academic. It doesn't heal in the way that the religious practice of mindfulness heals. When that has gone sufficiently far and become reasonably well established in our moment-to-moment awareness, at least whilst we are awake, we will be able to pay full attention to the here now. Now, what is the significance of paying attention to the here now, as contrasted with paying attention to that which is past, which comes up in memory, or to what we are anticipating for the future? Paying attention to the here now means that we are actually attending to the actual living process in the moment. And we live only in this very moment. The previous moment's gone. The next moment hasn't come. And if we can become, we can grow in such a manner that we become wholly attentive to the immediate now, we are in tune with life. You will discover another thing, that as this power of paying, of living in the immediate now, fully attentive to the now, grows, you will be a center for the functioning of transcendent energies through you. Now, remember what we tried to do with our meditation at the end of Saturday afternoon's meeting. We dealt with the signs of the zodiac and some of their deep characteristics. These transcendent energies, which exist all the time around us, will enter into the receptive person, the person who is free enough in himself to allow those energies access into his being, and they flow out, influencing the environment. So, paying full attention to the here now means that you are fully attentive to the immediate percept. You are perceiving the now, immediately. And that perception is not interfered with by all concepts. It's not interfered with. You cognize the percept in its fullness because of the concept. This is not very easy. Get this clearly. Percepts as such, when we first have them are not known by us. It is something new. When you have the very first percept before you, you don't know what it is. Whether it be a sight, a shape, a color, a sound, a smell, a taste, whatever it is. It's something totally new. And you naturally inquire within yourself, what is this? The answer is, I don't know what it is. Then, with the repetition of that same percept, it comes up again and again. Then at last you begin to recognize, oh yes, I saw that yesterday, I saw that 2 months ago too. Yes, I know that. And you're beginning to know it. So you get a concept formed. And the time comes when, at the very first glance or the very first hearing, you know at once what you're seeing or hearing. This is because of the concept. The concept is your mental card index for reference. And so it makes you recognize, recognize. The first cognition, the registering of the very first percept, is you don't know. You don't know it at the very first cognition. You have just seen something new. You don't know. But with the repetition of it and with the formation of the concept, the mental construct in your own mind, you recognize, you recognize. And then you're not in the state of not knowing. But the concept is a fossil. And the concept has this awful power to dismiss the immediate percept. Oh, I know that. That's my old grandpa. And he's dismissed just like that. There is no life perceiving. There is no living relationship each time I see grandpa. I mean, we all know this. Wives and husbands, brothers and sisters, parents and children, friends and friends, friends and enemies. And we react accordingly. Walk along the street. You meet somebody whom you know, whom you like. Oh, hello, how are you? Off you go and greet him or her or whoever it is. And you see somebody you don't like who is troublesome. What do? Your concept immediately comes up and says, oh, get on the other side of the road, look into the shop window. You see? And so forth. You see the attachment-aversion play. And in both cases, there is no true relationship. In the living moment, it is the concept which is interfering, which is inhibiting the actual living moment. Now, because the concept inhibits the actual living moment, one is not attending to the here now in fullness. That is why I said earlier on, we think we are attending to the here now, paying full attention to it, but we are not. Our attention is a vitiated attention. The concept is necessary only to the degree that it tells us what is the stimulus. Is it a sight? Is it a sound? Is it an object? Is it a person? It tells us that much. But having said that much, that person in the immediate now is that person, just as I am myself in the immediate now. And if all my hard-boiled concepts cease to interfere, then he and I really meet. And in that real meeting, there is true relationship. There is real love, communion between the two. Now you'll find that when this can be when this becomes natural to us in our everyday life, we are in communion in the real sense with objects, situations, persons, ideas, experiences, with everything. We are in the actual state of communion. You have heard me use this phrase, the senses really are the cords of communion with which we are gifted. But they become cords of communion only through our mindfulness, this tremendous religious discipline of mindfulness. And remember that this mindfulness which we talk of in its fullness means that mind in its wholeness is there, not just our particular little thought process or desire process. In that state, we are in the condition of revelation. You have to experience this. It's impossible to tell another person just what happens. I might try and suggest something. This condition of revelation, this condition of pure love, which is operating, this condition of pure poise, the revelation is of the nature of knowing through being, that which is experienced through the sense avenues and the activity of the whole psychophysical organism. When this happens, then indeed the man, the living man, is the living God. Not only the image of God, not merely possessed of the potentiality of divinity, but the actual manifest divinity there. If you don't like the word divinity, use its exact equivalent, the perfect man, the full man is there. And this is implicit in this perfect mindfulness, which enables us to be wholly awake, wholly attentive in the immediate now, where no concept interferes with the perception. No memory interferes with it. You will find then that all the vast heap of mental impressions of the past, the Buddha said, the substrates for rebirth. All those vasanas, as the Upanishads, that's the Upanishadic term, the vasanas, they are all at an end. And this division of the mind into the subconscious, unconscious mind on the one hand, and the conscious mind on the other hand, is all out. There is only one mind. Then we are no longer fragmented in the mind. The mind as a whole functions as a whole all the time. And if the mind as a whole in us, essentially therefore the psyche, functions in that way, you are in harmony with the universal mind. This is a real meaning of terms like cosmic consciousness. People misunderstand this term, cosmic consciousness, horribly. They picture it as sort of containing in your imagination the totality of separate things which constitute the universe. Well, that's impossible. If you try to do that, the mind, one's own mind, undergoes what dear Mother Frog underwent when she said, was there a creature who trod upon the little ones big as this, until the frog burst? I mean, of course, this is putting it a little bit humorously, but it has its very serious side. People do attempt all these foolish things, thinking they are going to be great alchemists or yogis or magicians or God knows what not, and they just go potty. This is a fact. So you see, the right way, mindfulness. Now look at the implications and look at the way this develops. It starts with the right basis. Now this is yoga in the grand sense. The right basis of first, the purification of the psyche through the moralities and the observances, what are commonly called the religious observances. In Catholic terms, the instruments of grace, the preliminary instruments of grace. It starts with that. When that foundation is present, the nervous system will be quiet. It will be strong. Add to that afterwards the disciplining of the body, which releases potencies which are other than physical. The right discipline of the body, as in the yogic asanas and pranayama, releases deep mental forces. So, when you have the yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, then you are ready prepared for the profounder aspects of meditation. Now, you may recall, we saw the other morning, that we live at the level of the three lower centers, Muladhara, Swadhisthana, and Manipura. The base of the spine, the genitals, and the navel. Do remember that these are convenient symbolic associations. You won't find any marvelous batteries or secret somethings which bug this system, you see, for the transcendent to know what we are about. Situated anywhere. This is a convenient way of looking at it. And it has convenient, it's a convenient analogical way too. Helpful. But no more. We live at the level of these three centers, which means food, sex, and business, the everyday business. Manipura, I've told you the meaning of Muladhara, root support, Swadhisthana, own abode, that which expresses your individual separate self in supremest measure, because the sexual function and its exercise is the supreme expression of self. The I is expressed there as separate from the rest of the world. And Manipura means the jeweled city or jeweled fortress. Pura is a city which is a fortress. It has a wall around it. That is a Pura. You see? Kaunpur means the walled city whose name was Kaun. You see? Anything ending with Pura is that. It's the jeweled city. It's very interesting. It's the jeweled city. And it deals, the textbooks will just say it deals with digestion. Now, the Manipura chakra doesn't deal with digestion. Your insides and your intestines and so on deal with the digestion. But the Manipura chakra is associated with that, because that is the psychical counterpart of your digestive system, which deals with the digestion of your thoughts and your feelings. Also your speech, and so on. What do I think and feel throughout the day? Now all this goes into this psychical tummy, Manipura, and it undergoes the process of digestion. Now you know, if you eat the right food, such and such digestive results will follow. And if you eat the wrong food, slightly different digestive effects will follow, usually unpleasant. Now consider this quite seriously in terms of our thoughts and feelings. What sort of thoughts and feelings do we go through the whole day? Again, mindfulness. You see the overwhelming importance of mindfulness. I've been trying to devote this whole summer school's work towards this central feature of mindfulness. What will happen to my psychical health if my thoughts and feelings, which are the psychical food, are the wrong food? And is it possible for my thoughts and feelings to be the right food if I am subject to attachment and aversion? If I am the slave of the pleasure drive? If I am so foolish as not to see that in the world of duality, pleasure and pain will just come and go in the ordinary way, and my business is just to deal with them, take them in my stride and deal with them in the right manner and let them pass by and remain poised and unmoved. You see, I must see all these things, mustn't I? Be mindful in this way. And then the thoughts and feelings will be the right food for the psyche. What happens to the psyche then? What is the meaning of the assimilation of psychical food by the psyche so that the psyche becomes healthy and strong? What does it mean, essentially? It means, essentially, that the psyche becomes increasingly sensitive, increasingly receptive to stimuli, and increasingly responsive. Everything is experienced in finer and finer degree. For example, in this place, this center, we have lovely trees and so on around us. It's a beautiful place. It's a quiet place. Now, supposing I was a person who was altogether a bit of an oaf, a worldling, I'd just take a glance and I'd say, pretty. And that would be the end. But what has happened inside my psyche thereby? Nothing special has registered. Perhaps a blob here and a blob there on the canvas of the psyche. Quite an uninteresting picture, to put it at its kindest, and a thoroughly ugly thing to tell the truth of it. Isn't that so? But if I am mindful, if there is this purity, they are present, and this intense real mindfulness, I am immediately in communion with the living beauty of the place when I see it. I am able to be wholly attentive here now to the beauty of the place. And being wholly attentive, there is nothing coming out of me which is a blot upon the beauty around me. I'm sure all of you have experienced this. You go out for a picnic to a lovely woodland region, and you're sitting quietly, really taking it in, being in perfect harmony with it. And there comes a body of roistering, rowdy fellows, breaking bottles and scattering litter and so forth. Now, are they or are they not a blot upon the beauty around? And it's only man that can do it. Have you ever seen a bird do that? Or an animal do that? Are they not completely in harmony with the loveliness around? Does not their movement, their singing or whatever it is, speak of the eternal order of things that underlies everything? Now, if we are mindful, we too are part and parcel of nature, not separate from nature, and therefore not against transcendence, an obstruction to transcendence. This is a matter of mindfulness. So, living that way, Manipura functions as it should function. In terms of ordinary thoughts and feelings of everyday life and worldly affairs, try and imagine, right now, try and imagine what would happen in the world of affairs. And the world of affairs particularly means the whole world of commerce, business. We all have to work to earn our living and so on. That means business, the business world. What would happen if our business had this sort of understanding and spirit underlying it? Just think. Picture the big cities of the world at rush hour. Is it not likely that at least a great part of the horror of rush hour would disappear? That there'd be harmonious movement. There could be swift movement, but harmonious, beautiful movement. Look at a flock of birds flying. How suddenly they will rise up and just fill your soul with amazement at the order and the harmony, the beauty of it all. And no collisions amongst the birds. No collisions. Manipura is concerned with all that. Now, if these three centers, through mindfulness, are made healthy, well prepared, then we can rise to the next one, Anahata, the heart center, as they call it. In the Kabbalistic system, Tiferet, as it is called. This heart center is the center which characterizes man, the human man, not the subhuman. This is the real social center. where I have a real sense, an awakened active sense, of being part and parcel of one mankind, of being in relationship all the time with every single living being I meet. And remember that the meeting is the immediate living percept, uninterfered with by the concept, which will dismiss the living person like that. And if you can just use your imagination vividly now and see the difference it would make to mankind as a whole. If we could really sort of live like this and spread this influence. And this is anahata, the heart center as we call it. This heart center is the one which represents symbolically the Son of Man who is in touch with his Father God, with the Supreme Center. If you want to use the Upanishadic terms, here resides Vishnu. And he is at one with Shiva, who resides right at the brain center, the seventh center. The brain center itself is often divided into six other centers, but we won't go into too much spiritual anatomy. Too many people do that, merely indulging their imaginations. So now, when this is awakened and it begins to function, because the psyche is pure, because the body is trained and can call forth into action the profounder powers, the profounder energies which are present in mind, then oneself is becoming the center, the right sort of center, for the flow of transcendent energies. I mentioned Shiva and Vishnu at the heart center and Shiva at the brain center. Brahma resides right down at the Mooladhara and Svadhisthana, the Father God. You see the natural associations. Biological creation is the representative in the world of matter and of things of this transcendent creative energy and process which is right up here. But mindfulness all the time. At anahata is the first great possibility of complete mindfulness in the full sense of the word mind, the universal mind. And it manifests as this oneness with all humanity, a real oneness. You are actually aware of it. Now, when I say actually aware, I do not mean that you merely hold a thought, a string of words in your mind. The string of words by itself is just a finger pointing at the moon. It's just a pointer. It is cold intellect. It hasn't got life power behind it. But that is a starting point. If you don't have the board telling you that this is the way to Park Place Pastoral Center, You might get into Cornwall or the North Pole. You have to have your right pointer. So, the string of words, the thought, is there of this oneness of all life. How easily we throw out these words, don't we? Stand up on the platform and give a most inspiring and rousing talk, you know. All life is one and this, that and the other, and off we go. Dividing life up into as many fragments as we possibly can divide it up. Here starts the great yoga at Anahata. The Pratyahara, Dharana, Dhyana, Samadhi starts here. When one is man, we have dealt so far, quite briefly of course, with the first four aspects, yama, niyama, asana, pranayama. Now, ascending here, there is pratyahara, usually translated as the withdrawal of the senses from the objects of sense. Now, I do think that this is very poorly put in the texts, translating it as the withdrawal of the senses from the objects of sense. You simply cannot do it. If you walk down Oxford Street with all your senses withdrawn from all the objects around you, that will be the last walk you'll ever have. And what is even worse, it will be an awful nuisance and a mess around which somebody else has to deal with. I suggest we have no right to inflict such a mess upon others. So, do not attempt to withdraw your attention from the objects of sense. What is this real pratyahara? Recall what we have already touched upon. Non-grasping. And the meaning of non-grasping. If I grasp something, mentally or physically, that grasps me. I mentioned a little while ago that being fond of music, some melody or other obsesses my mind. There is a case of the absence of pratyahara. I'm so enamored of the tune, and my psyche so clings to it that it clings to me afterwards and says, "Right you are, Feroz, I'm with you, come on. I've come to stay for the rest of my days here, free of charge." Now you see, whatever I grasp, that thing grasps me. And take the other case, something which is unpleasant or something which causes fear or anxiety, that grasps me and I can't let go of it. Because I have a different vested interest with which this thing which causes fear or anxiety clashes. Everything is inside me. If I didn't have this vested interest, that thing wouldn't worry me at all. So now, take the two opposites like that. You see, grasping includes both aspects. Therefore, it includes attachment and aversion. Now, if there is no attachment or aversion to everything that is conveyed to us, material or non-material, through the senses, then that is the state of pratyahara, the freedom from non-grasping of everything that comes through the senses. And the discursive mind, remember, in India has always been included as the sixth sense. both in Hindu and Buddhist teaching. The mind, this discursive mind, is a sixth sense. They don't put it in the realm of pure mind. So that's the meaning of pratyahara. Now, as we saw a little while ago, if that is the case, then I'm so attentive to the immediate now, the actual living percept, free of all isolative self-consciousness, that this psychophysical organism is the center for the inflow and outflow of transcendent energies. When that is the case, the other element after pratyahara, dharana, comes into being. You will find in the Upanishads too that dharana is given some strange translations. They use the word remembrance. They say, you won't find this in the usual volumes of the Upanishads, the so-called 12 or 13 major Upanishads. You'll only find it in the Yoga Upanishads. They say that it is holding the thought of Brahman continuously in your mind. Well, you can't hold a thought like that continuously in your mind, which has any significance or meaning. If you just go muttering Brahman, 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 as so many of them do, you know. They go on Ram, 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 till poor old Ram in the heaven shouts out, I wish that idiot would shut up. You see? They go on doing that and thinking themselves sort of growing in holiness, you know. They get a seraphic expression on their countenance and they look as empty as scraped out coconut shells. No, these are all the absurdities. All this giving of the word, the mantra, by the teacher to the disciple is a marvelous piece of humbuggery. The person who knows, who understands, can use a mantra. When he utters the word of truth, it's an utterance with power. It brings about results. But all this sort of thing brings no results apart from self-hypnosis. It's a psychological drug, that's all. These are the psychological hippies. Then they wake up out of it and they go for the next mantra. This is not the way to use mantras. There is a way, a right way. So, dharana then. It's not this senseless repetition. Dharana means upholding. It comes from the root. Comes from the root dri, meaning to uphold. What you uphold is ritta, the eternal order of things. We'll go on from there after you've had your coffee. Because it's 11 o'clock, I'm very sorry. You should have indicated to me. This Manipura chakra went too much into the transcendental realms and kept you away from your physical counterpart. Now we have just said that dharana means the upholding of ritta, and ritta means the eternal order of things. The order which is not imposed from outside, but which is inherent in existence. This is the important thing to bear in mind. It is this kind of order, the order which is inherent in our very being, which has to function unhindered. Now there is another way of looking at this upholding of ritta. It is said in the Rig Veda, that the great gods of the Rig Veda are sons of Rudra. They are sons of the eternal order. They represent the different archetypal forms of manifestation of this one great cosmic order. That is what they fundamentally stand for, as well as states of consciousness in ourselves which correspond to these different manifestations. Now, when one has realized that, then the Buddhist Brahma Viharic meditations, I think you, practically all of you do know that, the meditations on loving kindness or metta, maitri the Sanskrit, on karuna, compassion, mudita, sympathetic joy, and upekha, equanimity. These meditations become a reality in the supreme and complete sense of the word, because these meditations involve the at-one-ment in innermost consciousness with the totality of existence. You know how with maitri, with metta, you send out, as it is said, loving kindness to the four quarters of the world, to your teacher, to your friend, to your acquaintance, and everybody and everything. Unless and until one can maintain this inward silence and peace and poise and so forth, until one is so empty oneself that the mind in its transcendent wholeness functions right through you, until then, all that we do with these meditations is to go through a discursive meditation process, which of course is inevitably a starting point. But think of it carefully. What is it in actuality? It is a verbal ritual. It is like any sort of ordinary religious ceremony. One goes through a verbal structure. Now that verbal structure must not be dismissed as utterly useless. Very often it is. It is useless. You just mumble the words and you are not there. What is that sentence which the King of Denmark uses in Hamlet? My words
stay down. Something is dead.
Yes?
Something goes up.
My thoughts. Yes. Meaning that whilst his words may be fine and noble, actually his thoughts do not fly to heaven. His awareness is not with the real good. Now this is very important to bear in mind. So the Brahma Viharic meditations become a real potency only when one has realized that state of dharana, the upholding of the eternal order of things, which can only be done if oneself is empty of all defilements and one is capable of pure mindfulness. Let's come back to this word anahata, this heart center. The meaning of anahata is the place where the munis, I'm going to use that word muni, which is the word actually used in the texts, where the munis hear the sound that is made without striking two things together. Anahata is the place where the munis hear the sound that is made without striking two things together. Who is the muni? They usually translate somewhat loosely an ascetic or Holy One or something like that. But the specific meaning of Muni is the most important thing we must consider. The Muni is the silent one. Now remember that in the old days, the discipline in so many religious systems starts with complete silence where speaking with one's mouth is concerned, speaking aloud. One keeps one's mouth shut, completely shut. You know the akoustikoi in the schools of the Greek mysteries, Pythagoras and the others. The akoustikoi were the listeners. They never spoke. That is the first stage. And it's a terrible discipline. Have you ever tried it? And they were akoustikoi for at least 2 years. But the Muni is the one who is not silent merely with his tongue. He speaks when necessary. He is silent in his mind. That flow of silent chatter which goes through the brain all day and most of the night, except in the really profound dreamless slumber. Then only it sleeps. But it goes through the mind all the day, this chatter, chatter, chatter. Inconsequential, worldly, and so on. This is silent. Why? Because he's able to be fully attentive to the here now, the immediate present, without any interference from his concepts, etc., upon his immediate living percept. So now, what then is the sound that he hears without striking two things together? When you are in this extreme, this perfect quietude, I have to use the word hear metaphorically, you hear the pulse of life, the pulse of creation. If you're fortunate enough, you can try it yourselves and experience something quite unusual. Especially when you wake up after a good rest and the body has the tendency to be absolutely still. In that stillness, you get fully awake without opening your eyes, or if you like, even with your eyes open, but it is easier without opening your eyes, at least I found it so. Without opening your eyes, in that tremendous stillness, suddenly you find this simultaneity of the ending of all manifestation as well as the coming into being of all manifestation. It is as if your body is and is not simultaneously. It's a pulse, a vibration like that. The is not. At an incredible rapidity, and your awareness is totally empty of any obstruction to the sense of universality. The same thing happens to your feelings, your thoughts, your whole mental process. This is something you must be very careful about it. There must be complete stillness, and it must be a natural, spontaneous stillness. You, in other words, actually experience the pulse of life, and remember that if any words come descriptively at the time of the experiencing, don't deceive yourself that you are experiencing. You're not. The descriptive words come through the activity of the brain and through your ordinary knowledge afterwards, when you've gone out of that state. Because such states are non-descript. Why are they non-descript? Because they are infinite. because they belong to the state of immortality. It is experiencing of this sort which is the real root and the real meaning of words like immortality and deathlessness. You see how the theologies of the world have gone quite haywire on the whole, talking about immortality and so forth. But this is the reality. It's a matter of your attentiveness, your chit. You look at the Upanishadic definition of Brahman, Sat Chit Ananda, being, attentiveness, bliss. Then that will come to life, the meaning of it. So anahata is the place where you hear the pulse of life. And if you hear the pulse of life, you will appreciate what I said earlier on, that here is the place where all mankind is gathered in. You take all mankind to your heart. Not only mankind, but the totality, everything, you take to your heart. And therefore, nothing is rejected, nothing is offended, nothing is hurt. You are in the harmless state, and hence the real Brahma Vihara, the divine residence, the union with Brahma, the Father God, is actually present there. Then it is a real power functioning through you. So that's anahata. Now, when we come to the next chakra, Vishuddhi, which is associated with the throat center, which is the throat center as they call it. Vishuddhi means made utterly pure, utterly cleansed of all ill. Now, Vishuddhi is associated with the throat because it is also associated, listen carefully, with speech. But what speech is this speech? This is not the chatter which has to become completely silent, both spoken aloud in words and this endless stream of mental chatter that goes on inside the brain. It is prophetic speech. Nothing to do with foretelling the future. Nothing at all to do with all that. It is speech in this sense. When he who has realized is in that situation where he has to speak, he speaks only of the one thing worthwhile talking about, and that is truth in the religious context, reality, transcendence. If you like to use the theistic word, God. You find Eckhart in one of his sermons saying precisely that. The godly man verily talks only of God. And the Buddha said very clearly, he simply categorically cut out all conversation apart from talk about Dhamma, about the truth, about the teaching. See? And that too in right season, with the fewest possible words, clearly, succinctly put. So then, this speech which the Muni, the silent one, utters, is prophetic speech, meaning words which when spoken so stimulate the other healingly, lovingly, that he rises into the vision of transcendence himself. And he is stirred. We used that phrase, the hound of heaven, the other day. The hound of heaven now takes him along the path to the heights of transcendence. That is the speech which is prophetic speech. You read all your Old Testament prophets with that understanding and see what different meanings will appear in all that they said. At least in so many parts of what they said. So now, Vishuddhi, made pure. And you get prophetic speech. Next, in the yogic discipline, after dharana, we have dhyana, meditation. And dhyana culminates in samadhi, the supreme communion. And this is associated with these two chakras between the eyebrows, the Ajna chakra, as it is called, and the Sahasrara, the thousand-petaled lotus. The thousand-petaled lotus. Now, this Ajna chakra is the center which is associated with this teaching. It is the place where one hears the command of the master, of the teacher. But now think carefully. Who is the teacher? Where is this teacher? Where is this teacher? It is not another person. You are in meditation, remember, by yourself, entering into the deeps, the innermost depths of awareness. Every stimulus, everything that you have realized through your own living experience is transformed here, completely beyond the realm of words and thoughts, into an understanding of reality through being that reality. You can't describe it because this is shapeless, formless, it has no beginning, it has no ending, it has no measure, no dimensions, no characteristics. But having been in this state, on returning to ordinary consciousness, it will affect the brain and nervous system and the whole material which we have at hand of speech and concepts comes into play, and you could present something in words which bears some real correspondence with this inner state. So the teacher is the one who is within yourself. Look within, thou art Buddha. Within you is the kingdom of heaven. That is one translation. But the other translation is, the kingdom of heaven is among you. Subtle difference. Very difficult to explain. The kingdom of heaven is among you. And the word you in that context, I would say, signifies the whole of your being, your total psychophysical being. And since the total psychophysical being is composed of such a variety of aspects and parts, that it is like a whole world there. And the kingdom of heaven is among you. It's very curious, isn't it? And this is the Ajna chakra, the Sahasrara, the thousand-petaled one, where Shiva himself resides. This is the ultimate for man, as he is at present constituted. When I use the word ultimate, please don't think that I'm talking of a finality. There is no such thing as a finality. We can go to the limits to which we as human beings can go, and that is all we can do. But it is absurd, apart from being very conceited, to think that our limits are the limits of transcendence. Transcendence knows no limits. So, as far as human beings can go, this is the ultimate limit, the realization of transcendence which is associated with the brain region. This is the meaning of heaven, way down from the Rig Vedic days. Vyoman, they called it. This is Vyoman. This is the middle region, Antariksha. And this is earth, in the Rig Veda. Now, in the Mundaka Upanishad, it is stated that the earth is the footing of the Lord. If you like, the footstool of the Lord. The heaven is his crown, his throne. The words of Isaiah, the heaven is my throne, the earth is my footing, is my footstool. What manner of house will ye build unto me? And what shall be my rest? The heaven is my throne, the earth is my footstool. What manner of house shall ye build for me? And what shall be my rest? The Lord God asks that of man. And the answer of the yogi is this. This body, O Lord, is thy house. The pure, perfected body. Thou shalt live at Anahata. And in the ending of this body, thou shalt reach thy Sabbath through Sahasrara. If you can really meditate on that, outgo all the personalistic, limited, anthropomorphic conceptions and so forth, you will realize something so profound that it will utterly transform your whole mind, your outlook on life. If you can feel this here and now, you will understand the extraordinary mercy, the loving kindness, the compassion of the eternal order of things that brought this body into being. And how true it is that man, the microcosm, is the reflection of the ultimate reality, the macrocosm. The reflection. Man in the image of God. But when man has completely purified himself and come to his fulfillment, then he is not merely the image. He is the living God embodied. Because the transcendent residing here is completely united with fundamental energy because of which the body came into being and subsists, which is associated with the base of the spine, mula dhara, root support. And this energy has risen upwards through all the chakras and found union with the Lord. And to use the Indian terms, Shakti, that is power, energy, has ascended, and she is female. She has ascended and united herself with her Lord. Now the story doesn't end there. There are some texts which say that Shiva, the united Shiva Shakti, come down again and reside at Anahata. Now, those of you who are interested in that account of the Buddha's death and the various jhanas and samapattis he goes through and comes back to the fourth jhana. Not at the highest samadhi, not at the cessation as it is called, but at the fourth jhana, and then he gives up the ghost. The body dies. You can relate that to this. Shiva Shakti reside here. At this, the level of all mankind, of all humanity. But I put it differently myself. I don't know, but there may be some text, Sanskrit text, which contains this, but I've never read it. No one has ever told me. But it's clear to me that they go, that the united Shiva Shakti goes right down to Mooladhara and then begins to rise up again to Anahata. Or what happens with this coming down below Anahata to the worldly regions of Manipura, Swadhisthana and Mooladhara? This united Shiva Shakti transcendentalizes all the manifestations of the energy which runs the daily living process. Food, sex, commerce. It is transcendentalized. And in its transcendentalization, all desire, all concupiscence, all selfness is completely out. So the activities which are associated with the self, the preservation of the self, and the ordinary limited things in the dualistic world are lifted to the level of divinity itself. The king can do no wrong. This is the meaning. What sort of a world would it be if there were such people? Having transcendentalized all that, it rises up and stays there, the united Shiva Shakti. And as I said, this is the manner of house that is built for the Lord, to use Isaiah's words. Whilst the body is alive, and in the final dissolution of the body, there is the movement out through Sahasrara of transcendence back to transcendence. In the Upanishads, and you have, I'm sure you have read it not only in Upanishads but in some other writings too, they say that the yogi who at the time of death, the death of the body, is concentrated upon Brahman, goes up by the channel, the nadi, the heater, which goes right through the sagittal suture of the head. But remember, this is symbolic. At least I say it is symbolic, whatsoever the others in India may say. This is a useful, symbolic way of looking at it. It goes right through here, because Shiva, the supreme, the transcendent, is associated with this path. And therefore, that which was embodied, made finite, is once more back into non-being, the infinite, the other life, which is the counterpart of manifested limited life. And in that is the crowning fulfillment of the yogi. And this is, the whole of yoga gets comprised in this. Do see the importance then of the whole of the discipline, the purification of the psyche, then the training of the body in order that subtle powers may be released, and the final meditative process extending from pratyahara right up to samadhi.